This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take to the streets to hear from participants of the People's Climate March.
Hopefully, this mass action will signify the beginning of the end of global warming. Marches are going on not just in New York, where you'll hear the voices of marchers, but all over the world.
The National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild has launched a lawsuit challenging the fast-track deportation process of families and children who fled here from Central America.
We talk with a lawyer from the National Lawyers Guild National Immigration Project, which is trying to do something to ameliorate the horrible situation these children find themselves in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, the U.S. recently began bombing the Islamic State, or ISIL, with the promise that there will be no ground troops. Let's talk a bit about the legality of this.
I think the legality here is important, but of course the first thing is this was a promise not to use any ground troops. That was Obama made that publicly, and a few days later, perhaps 2 days later, General Martin Dempsey, who's head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said he would not rule out the use of ground troops and said that if necessary, he would recommend that to the president. The Times then wrote a very strong editorial saying, here we go again, a slippery slope into a ground war, an endless war in the Middle East. Not that I think they didn't have ground troops in there already. They did. They call them advisors. Who knows what they're really doing? I know my experience with, quote, advisors, whether back in Vietnam and or El Salvador, is they don't just stand there with no weapons. They often accompany the troops. They give advice. And they, if they're fired upon, they have the right to fire back.
And are the advisors sort of top-level military personnel? Who are they exactly?
I don't think they're necessarily top-level. Some are, but some are training units, et cetera. So I think we already are having a certain number of, quote, ground troops there. But certainly General Dempsey's statement indicates that we're only seeing the beginning. And as usual, the U.S. population is, quote, being lulled into another major ground war in the Middle East. One question is, as lawyers, and this is technically a lawyer show, is the question of the legality of what the president is doing. And I've spent, as a number of us have, a lot of our lives trying to restrain U.S. war powers, and the U.S., particularly the president or the Congress together, going to war around the world. And it's been a task that has been singularly unsuccessful, starting with Vietnam, where we brought case after case, and only at the very end of the war, really, did Congress finally act to restrict the president after there were secret wars carried out in Cambodia and Laos, not just Vietnam, as the devastation became too great, as the opposition here became great, and really, as the Vietnamese started to win the war.
Now, Michael, let's just give a basic lesson in government structure. Right now, what could Congress do to restrain the president?
Let's step back 1 second, Heidi, and that is where I'm going. Right now, the president has not asked for any authority from Congress to either bomb targets in Iraq that he claims are Islamic State targets, or presumably if they've begun it, bombing in Syria, again targets that they claim are Islamic State targets. He has not asked for any authority. He has, of course, had to use some funding that Congress, I think, will approve if he asks for more. That is not considered the giving authority by Congress just because they fund a war. That's some specific legislation. But let's talk about what the president should be required to do and essentially how my office, other people, and I've litigated a dozen cases around the war, have utterly failed to be able to force the president to obey the Constitution or to force the president and Congress to obey the UN Charter, which also has a prohibition on the use of force. Coming out of Vietnam, Congress did a sort of mea culpa. They said, well, the president dragged us into this war. We passed this Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was this open-ended resolution that the president said he could do whatever he wanted in Vietnam. And he kept fighting the war based on this one broad authorization the Congress gave him over a false incident that took place when one on a Vietnamese boat supposedly, but did not, actually fire on a U.S. ship. President went to the Congress and they passed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. They fought that war for years based on that open-ended resolution.
Sort of like the weapons of mass destruction justification.
Like that, exactly. That resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, you could liken to the authority that Congress gave the president to go to war in Afghanistan, called the authorization to use military force. But let's keep stepping back to Vietnam. So after Vietnam cost some 50,000 plus American lives, perhaps 2 million Vietnamese lives, devastation of our country politically and in the streets, but particularly, of course, in Vietnam, where it's still paying a very heavy cost from Agent Orange to the numbers of people killed. So Congress then passes what's called a War Powers Resolution. People hear that bandied about a lot. What the War Powers Resolution did was Congress said to itself, look, we don't want to be in the situation of Vietnam again. The president, yes, is required to go to Congress before he can go to war with any country. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the U.S. Constitution. The framers were very clear. We don't want a president making war on his own. We want war to be harder to make, not easier. We think it's harder to make if the people who are actually representatives of people and who are paying the costs and or losing their children will have to consent to that war. As one of the framers said, we want, I think the word cloying, we want it made harder to make war. Now, of course, since that time, presidents have just taken it upon themselves again and again to make war on their own. So you get to Vietnam and Congress says, we're going to make a special statute. You still need a declaration of war or a particular passage by Congress of a statute authorizing war before you can make war. But just in case the president goes in to a country without getting the declaration from us or statute allowing it, we're going to say that he can only stay in that country for 60 days. And after the 60 days, he is required to pull out all troops from that country without Congress doing anything. Because Congress recognized that they have trouble acting in the midst of a war the president has begun.
So it's like a safety valve built in.
Right. It's an automatic safety valve that basically says you stop those troops after 60 days. We'll give you another 30 days to get them out, but get them out. So it's automatic. So at the same time as they passed that, President Nixon vetoed it. They overrode his veto. It was that strong. But of course, there's never been any compliance with the War Powers Resolution in the history of our country, which is to say, when the 60-day clock has run, there has never been a case where the president has actually pulled out the troops. I've litigated that. I litigated it with El Salvador when the U.S. sent in, quote, advisors into El Salvador. I've litigated it in other countries. We litigated it in Grenada and other places. It's never happened.
And what was the response in court, that there was governmental immunity?
We litigate these normally on three bases. One is that noncompliance with the War Powers Resolution, you're not pulling them out in 60 days. Secondly, noncompliance with the U.S. Constitution, which is it's the Congress that has to declare war and not the president. And third, noncompliance with the U.N. Charter, which says there can be no use of force by any member state unless it's self-defense or the Security Council approves it. So we always litigate these wars on those three bases. The response is generally or sometimes War Powers Constitution is unconstitutional or you can't enforce it because you can't make it so that the president has to do something without Congress telling him to do it, one. Secondly, they say that you don't have a right to litigate the war powers of the Constitution. That's between Congress and the president, and an individual can't do that, even though we've done that on behalf of soldiers who say they don't want to serve. And the third one, they say the UN Charter, yes, it may have a prohibition on the use of force, but it's a treaty, and treaties can't be enforced in U.S. courts. They're not what we call enforceable by U.S. courts. So we failed on all of those.
Have you brought those cases in more recent times, post-Vietnam?
Yes, we brought cases. I brought cases with another co-counsel of mine, Jules Lobel, in the Center for Constitutional Rights. We brought them in El Salvador regarding the war in El Salvador in the 80s, in Nicaragua in the 80s, the invasion of Grenada in the 80s. We also brought one on the war in the first Iraq war, which is 1990s. And then we brought one on Clinton's bombing of Kosovo. We lost them all. In the beginning, we came close to winning. Right after the Vietnam War, which was the first El Salvador case, which is to say the judge said, well, I think the War Powers Resolution may apply here, but we can't prove that there's enough hostilities going on there to trigger the statute. By the end, we were losing. The cases weren't close anymore. We were just getting dismissed. So we sort of gave up on the idea that you could actually litigate the war powers. And so now when we read a lot about people saying, well, this violates the Constitution, it violates the UN Charter, violates the War Powers Resolution. I think, yes, that's all true, and we all ought to say it. But really, how important is it? Yes, it's always important to point out violations. And I saw Noam Chomsky and others pointed out one in the Times the other day, saying this violates the UN Charter to go after the Islamic State in the way the U.S. is right now. And I think it has to be said, but the problem here is not really a problem of law. The problem is a problem of having a hegemonic imperialist country that dominates the world through force. So that turns us back to where we are right now. So if you look at the attack on ISIS or on the Islamic State, we're not using supposedly, let's accept for a second we don't have combat troops in there. But the war powers limitations that you can't go to war without UN or the Congress, still apply. They apply to bombings. It doesn't just say anything about troops on the ground. It applies to the use of force, to the creation of hostilities, or to use of force. So that is not a distinction. But Obama is clearly violating this, as probably every president before him has violated it. If we look at what Obama's justifications are, he has two justifications that they've sort of articulated well, but sort of said. One is that the original grant of authority to bomb and go and use force and U.S. troops in Afghanistan, called the Authorization to Use Military Force, passed shortly after 9/11 in 2001, which basically said the president could use force to go after the perpetrators of 9/11, those who harbored them, or those who aided and abetted them. That's the authority that the U.S. went into Afghanistan on, and that's the authority which is the equivalent of the Gulf of Tonkin, in my view, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. That's the authority that the president has used now to go into war everywhere.
Right.
Not just continue in Afghanistan when the Taliban has been pushed out, but go into Yemen, to go into Somalia.
It's like a blank checkbook that right. He can use wherever he wants.
Because he claims everybody's affiliated with Al-Qaeda in some right. way, or everybody's affiliated with 9/11. And where that really breaks down now is the claim that somehow we can go after the Islamic State based on that. Because in this case, in the case of the Islamic State, they're actually at war with and have been denounced by Al-Qaeda. So they're not part of, certainly not part of any 9/11 conspiracy mm-hmm. at all. They may be in some future time, according to somebody, some kind of threat to the United States, although there's a lot of people who think they're not. But they are if they are, then the president should go to Congress and actually get an explicit statute authorizing the war. And then he should go to the UN and try and get the Security Council to authorize that war. Now, so he doesn't have the authority under any of those bodies of law to go to war against the Islamic State, at least under the AUMF or the Authorization to Use Military Force. The other claim he has is that the bombings in Iraq against the Islamic State are authorized by the original Iraq War Resolution, which are wonderful and are really incredible. Senator Hillary Clinton voted in favor of to go to war with Iraq in 2003. And that resolution, of course, and that war is the one that has led to where we are today in the Middle East and led to the Islamic State. So we condemn Hillary heavily for that. No one should ever in their right mind think of supporting somebody who voted for that war. But in any case, that authorization, which is to essentially oust Saddam Hussein and get rid of chemical weapons, how in the heck can Obama claim that that resolution in a war that's ended and that we withdrew from our forces from Iraq somehow authorizes him to continue bombing Iraq. It doesn't. So there's no question, let's just put the bottom line here, that he's illegally bombing the Islamic State in Iraq, illegally bombing them to the extent he is in Syria as well. Now, I should say there's been some precursors to this. Let's take a look at the war in Libya that happened a couple of years ago. There was a resolution out of the United Nations that authorized NATO to support protective bombing, I think, to save people from a massacre, mm-hmm. Or the Benghazi, what was claimed to be
prophylactic bombing.
A massacre going on in Benghazi, which people have some questions about. And they did get UN Security Council authorization, although Russia and China abstained. Why is unimaginable to me. They claimed that they were told a false story, that the bombing was just to be used for, you know, safe zones or something like that. But in any case, the U.S. never got U.S. Congress to approve the bombing of Libya, which is completely amazing to me. Shocking, and the State Department legal advisor, Harold Koh, wrote a legal opinion saying they didn't need to get the U.S. Congress to vote on it. Absurd, of course they did, but that just shows how the U.S. Congress and the requirement of our Constitution that the president get authority from Congress before beginning hostilities or use of force is essentially a nullity. So it's been a long lead up to this, but if you have to talk about an imperial presidency, or really more an imperial country, because they say we have an imperial presidency, of course it's true, but of course that reflects the country and reflects a consensus in the country that we like using force against other countries. Now, I'm not saying, although I did the litigation for years, I'm not saying that I think Congress would be a great stopgap here for going to war. I just thought that to the extent we could use Congress to somehow push back against the war, or some more members of Congress who either believed in the Constitution or didn't believe in the wars we were fighting, might create some tension around it, might help. But in fact, you know, Congress generally has funded every one of these wars, has gone along with every one of these wars, even if not explicitly, and in this case against the Islamic State. A lot of them say they don't want to vote on it because they don't want to either strengthen the president's hand while there's an election coming up, or weaken his hand if, because of the election coming up, etc. But in any case, you know, Congress is essentially useless. Utterly useless in these circumstances. The UN, of course, because the Security Council is dominated by the veto people, which whether it's the US or Russia or China, has trouble moving on these things. And so an imperial country is being given a free imperial hand in the Middle East.
We hear the voices from the climate march held in New York City, a large-scale activist event to advocate global action against climate change. The march winded through the streets of New York Sunday, September 21st. Initially called by 350.org, the environmental organization founded by writer-activist Bill McKibben, the march has been endorsed by nearly 400 organizations, including many international and national unions, churches, schools, and communities, as well as environmental justice organizations. The weekend action is intended to coincide with the UN Climate Summit this week, as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon invited leaders of government, the private sector, and civil society to meet and find solutions to climate change. The website peoplesclimate.org describes the event as a weekend to bend the course of history. They say, "We know that no single meeting or summit will solve climate change, and in many ways this moment will not even really be about the summit. We want this movement to be about us, the people who are standing up in our communities, to organize, to build power, to confront the power of fossil fuels, and to shift power to a just, safe, peaceful world. To do that, we need to act together." We caught up with several participants in the action in Manhattan.
My name is Michelle Struck, and I'm the Public Affairs Manager at Islamic Relief USA. We're an organization that works in over 20 countries around the world, working to alleviate poverty, suffering around the world, hunger, and illiteracy. And this event is really, really important for us. We put a lot of effort behind mobilizing our supporters and educating them on why it matters. Climate change is an issue that affects our work around the world because I think we've seen when we responded in Hurricane Sandy that a lot of effects of climate change tend to really hit the most vulnerable. They exacerbate a lot of natural disasters. We're the people that on the ground, we respond to disasters when they occur. So we see firsthand the way that people that are really in the worst situations are disproportionately affected. So we think that it's really important to bring the diversity of voices of the most vulnerable and of the organizations that work to respond to natural disasters to show that we should care about this issue and that the actions that we take now as a global community are going to affect us 20 years from now, 30 years from now. So I think that as an organization based on Islamic values, we care deeply about our future and about the future of our children and of our planet and our neighbors. So that's another reason that we look from a faith-based perspective to tell everyone that we should all be part of, you know, we are all part of one planet. We're custodians of this planet. It's our responsibility to take care of it. And so we've been working very hard to educate people and then join together with all of these groups of different faiths and labor unions and environmental groups to raise awareness on this.
Thank you so much.
My name is Suleiman Sheikh. I'm a development coordinator with Islamic Relief USA. We are here along with our staff and a good amount of our volunteers from the Northeast region, Virginia, New York, New Jersey. And we want the world to be a better place. And we know that climate change does have that domino effect and can make a lot of things easier for our fellow human beings all across the world. So we're here to show support, to encourage everybody, the governments throughout the entire world, which are coming here in a couple of days, as we know, to say, hey, look, we care about the climate. We put you in power. We put you in office. Take us seriously. Make those policy changes, and we'll be with you.
My name is Heather Page. I'm here at the High School Economics and Finance with our environmental science class. And I think it's important for the students to think about the planet they inhabit and how they can make it, you know, a good place for the people that are going to come behind them.
Hi, my name is Patrick Callahan. I'm an environmental science teacher at the High School Bronx Center for Science and Mathematics, located in the South Bronx. I'm here with students from my high school class, as well as members of our service organization called Build On. And we are here to get the word out that climate change is real, it's science, and we got to do something about it.
Okay. I'm Harris, and this will impact future generations, and we should stop it now before it hurts anyone else. We humans have to unite together. We have to group together, and we have to, you know, stop the root of the problem. And basically that's going to involve, you know, working together, you know, grouping up to stop big organizations that, you know, waste a lot of our energy, and we're going to really have to work together.
All right, so my name is Jamila Chafer, but most people call me DJ, and the Green Team is this organization in our school where we're going to teach people about the environment, how important it is to take care of it. We're going to do different projects to see if different plants will affect the way people learn and stuff in their classrooms. We're gonna have a recycling program where we're gonna collect bottles from the classrooms and return them for money for our school. And so this recycling program started last year. I started it with my friend Sarah Tapia. And what we do is that we go into each classroom after school and we collect bottles. We go into the basement, we separate them, and then we return them for money for our school. And the reason why we did this is because we saw that so many people were throwing away their bottles in the trash cans, and we were like, we could get money off of this. And a lot of people drink. We collected about 200 bottles a day, and that's a lot of money for our school. So we thought that, hey, why don't we start a recycling program in order to raise money for our school and teach people about the environment? We think that small efforts in our school could really make a big difference. So I never knew that the recycling program would turn into the Green Team, and hopefully this goes on for years in our school and people learn about the environment more.
My name is Michael Borello. I'm with the High School of Economics and Finance. It's downtown. And why this is important, it's because we're not really destroying the planet, but we're destroying it for ourselves. And that idea, like, I could get into it a little more if you want me to, but that's basically, like, the main idea of why I'm here. I'm part of the AP Environmental Science class because my school, like, you know, there's not a lot of money that's funded into public schools, so we don't have, like, a lot of resources to be into different clubs and everything like that, and my school doesn't have very many organized clubs, but I'm in my AP Environmental Science class, and I take part in that in discussions in that class and everything as much as I could.
I'm Jesse Benson, and I go to Archbishop Miller High School, and I'm in the I Am Green Club there, so, like, once a year we'll also, like, we gather up the computers and stuff. You know how you can't throw them in the regular garbage? So, like, we'll take a trip to where you're supposed to dispose of them, and we, like gift cards and stuff, like, I'm not sure if you're supposed to throw them in the regular garbage, because like we also collect those and dispose them somewhere, and we like recycle every day, and at lunch we'll take the garbage pails outside, and like because everybody has to walk outside and then come like past the garbage pails, and then so we get them to like recycle all the stuff that like that needs to be recycled, and then the regular trash is there too for the other stuff.
My name is Bill DiPaolo. I'm with Time's Up, which is a 27-year-old environmental organization in New York City. So it's amazing for us, you know, people who've been working in New York City for years, to see so many people come out in favor of the climate and the planet. As a lifelong environmentalist, I really feel like individuals can make a difference. New York City has changed so much in just the last 10 years, and it's just great to see all these different people out here today representing their different factions and all for the planet. A lot of people think, well, this is a big change, and are they really going to see it in their lifetime, and what can I do to make a difference in climate change, such a big issue. But if you just look at New York City, right where we are, right here at Columbus Circle, the whole infrastructure has changed here in the last 10 years. Just 10 years ago, we got an incredible amount of bike lanes, which led to greenways that wrap around the city, and the air quality in New York City has really changed. And right now, in the middle of Times Square, which is only a few blocks away, people are now sitting in chairs eating their lunch, and it's auto-free. And people raise their bikes up to demonstrate on the critical mass ride just 7 years ago to make it auto-free, and now it is. So change can happen, and people can steer change.
We see a lot of security marshals here, hundreds of them. What's that about?
Well, it seems like today's march is slightly a different style. We have a lot of different groups here from the left, from the right, probably Republicans and Democrats. Everybody's getting together and saying the climate is important, the planet's important. So we're seeing different type of organizers. We just saw 200 people wearing green shirts, and they weren't legal observers. They were actually marshals, and it says security marshal. And that's something you more see at union rallies and stuff. You don't really see the left organize with security. So to make everybody feel comfortable, everybody's bringing their own product to this. I wouldn't say it's a demonstration. I would say it's more of a celebration of what things can look like in the future. And also what's happening at the UN. People want to get the message across to the politicians, to the people at the UN, that everybody does care about the climate and the future of the planet.
Let me ask you this. Under the new mayoral administration, what are you noticing about the police presence, and what do you expect is going to happen?
Today's march is also really different. It's just the politicians are going to be in the march and not even questioning it. The mayor is going to be right at the front of the march. So this is something where everybody's getting on board, and I expect the climate today will represent that in a more peaceful fashion. Not a protest, but a celebration of what the future can look like.
Bill, I see quite an elaborate Noah's Ark filled with different individuals. What's the symbolism of that?
Well, this is great. We're seeing the left and the right. And, you know, the environmentalists have always used a lot of images to portray, you know, polar bears. We see people carrying windmills, which represent renewable wind power. We see a boat over there, which represents sea level change. And I know there's going to be hundreds of bicycles, and they're going to be actually fish on the side of the bike. So they're going to look like moving fish, and they're actually going to be weaving into traffic like water. So there's a lot of symbolism that we're going to see today that's color, and it's going to really, you know, get the message across about the planet. And the people that aren't here, the animals and the air and the water, are being represented by images.
Yeah,
there's exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So people are using recycled stuff to make banners, which is amazing. So you have, you know, the unions and stuff that have the usual posters, but we're seeing the contrast of these usual printed posters by Kinko's or Staples, some large organization, versus the grassroots recycled posters. We just saw people walk by with paper bags that they painted with a symbol of the earth on them. So it's so interesting to not only see people work together, but the images from, you know, the kind of corporate side and the grassroots side working together at one concept for the planet.
It's real grassroots creativity at work.
It really is. And I got a call this morning, you know, at Time's Up, and they said, do you have any extra posters or banners? And I had to explain to them that our stuff is handmade, that we, because they were like, oh, we just want to, like, get it, you know, for 100 people. Don't you have something we can hand out? We're like, I'm sorry, we're an environmental organization. Our stuff is handmade. And I think they were used to going to demonstrations where you just grab a sign. So we're seeing a little bit of everything here today.
I'm Alex Steinberg. I'm former board member from WBAI and the Pacifica Foundation, and I came down here to see what WBAI was doing and be an observer at this historic event. And my impression is that the turnout shows the potential for a real revolutionary change, and it's even more significant because there wasn't a single event that kicked this off. It was just an awareness that something is deeply wrong in the way we have our system set up. But on the other hand, I feel that this is a movement that is still trying to figure out what it needs to do. It hasn't really found its way. It's still looking at symbols of the past when it should be giving some direction to the future. There's a lot of 1960s style, I don't know what you call it, memorabilia and stuff like that. And this is not the 60s anymore. As much as I appreciate and am nostalgic about those days, and we're up to some huge issues. They face the whole planet, and the problem is capitalism. And I think there's going to be a more and more consciousness about that, and I hope that it will eventually cohere into a viable political movement. We don't have that yet.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month, the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild and several other groups sued the federal government to challenge its new and unlawful fast-track expedited removal policies that are being used against mothers and children detained in Artesia, New Mexico. Artesia is a remote detention center hundreds of miles from the nearest city. Lawyers with the National Immigration Project have collected evidence showing the government disregarding and pushing mothers and children through a deportation process, making it nearly impossible for them to consult attorneys, prepare their asylum claims, or any other defenses they might have to deportation. Today we're joined by attorney Paramita Shah, Associate Director of the National Immigration Project. She specializes in immigration detention and enforcement. She is the contributing author and co-presenter of the Deportation 101 curriculum. Paramita, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I know we're going to talk about children, mothers, immigration, detention, fast track, all these words, National Lawyers Guild and your lawsuit. But, in the last few weeks, months, we've seen a lot of press and ink about children and parents or children alone coming into the United States. And there's some kind of, you would almost say, a crisis from what you read in the papers. So give us some sense of what's happened and what some of the response of our government has been.
Right. Starting in probably early April, the government began to see a surge in arrivals of families, mothers and children, and sometimes children who came by themselves. And these children, many of them just started coming to the United States, and they just didn't flee their home countries. Predominantly these children and families come from the countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and they fled their home countries for a variety of reasons, mostly to escape what was horrific atrocities that they had experienced in their own country. And they came to the United States, and in actuality, they went to other countries as well, since other countries have seen a 700% increase in asylum claims, places like Costa Rica or Bolivia. I mean, these countries have also seen a rise in asylum cases, but many of them also came to the United States. Even though the surge, I think, became more apparent to us in the press several months ago, it actually is not new. The surge really began about 5 years ago when people began reporting a somewhat exponential increase of children coming across the border, and no one really knew what to do about it. And if you look at the statistics, you'll see this rise over the last 4 years. And over the last 4 years, we know there was, in 2009, there was a coup in Honduras. We also know that there were harsher enforcement policies here, gangs in El Salvador and Honduras, Guatemala became more of a threat, you know, became associated with police departments, with government agencies that are in control of law enforcement in those places. And then, of course, there was the problem of fairly harsh economic reforms in those countries that, you know, may have led to the migration. But from the stories that we have heard from the people that, you know, many of our members have seen and met with, they are fleeing horrific atrocities and came to the United States to seek refuge here.
Normally, if somebody is fleeing terrific atrocities, they have a right to seek asylum here. That's in our law. From what I understand, that's not so easy to do. And you're with the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild. That's started a lawsuit challenging what's going on now. Can you explain what you're trying to do?
Right. So the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild, the ACLU, and a number of organizations sued the federal government to challenge its policies that denied a fair deportation process to the families and children who have fled this extreme violence. And you know, the primary focus of our argument is that these people were not really given a chance to apply for asylum. And in doing so, we were violating our laws. We were violating our laws that relate to asylum, that relate to the Convention Against Torture. And these are laws that not only we have in the United States, but are international treaties that we've signed on to. And that abrogation of our laws was creating a life and death situation for these women and children.
Let me step back for 1 second before we go ahead on that, because I'm interested in what happens. They cross over into the United States.
Sure, I'm going to spell that out.
Okay, great.
So what would normally happen is if you were fleeing a country that had abused you and injured you, you would come to the United States border. And at that point, our laws set up a process called expedited removal, and it's a two-stage process. The first step involves the time that you are arrested by a Border Patrol agent. They conduct a short interview, and if you say that you have a fear of returning to your home country because of persecution and torture, then they will refer you to an interview, so for an interview by an asylum officer. So that's the first step. You'll have that interview by an asylum officer, and they're going to evaluate whether you have a credible fear.
Is that right at the border?
That's at the border.
So you don't need housing at the...
And when I say border, that's at any port of entry in the United States. So people who fly into the United States, right, at an airport, gotcha. This could happen at the border. And expedited removal as a process is applied anywhere within 100 miles of the border, because that's how we've defined the border in the United States, is 100 miles at any point from the border. So actually 2/3 of the United States population lives within 100 miles of the border. But, you know, that's where expedited removal is applied.
That's very clear. But what I'm interested in is they, you get either they come across, present themselves, or they get caught.
That's right.
One of two. And then where do they stay during this period, and what happens to them? Does this happen instantly? Do they need a place to stay at night? There's kids staying
here.
Right.
So if they, once they're caught, Border Patrol will bring them to a holding station where they ask them a few questions. And even though this isn't part of our lawsuit, we've engaged in other lawsuits and other complaints against the department for these holding cells that they keep people in. So Border Patrol has holding stations all across these border areas. Some of them you may have read about are called hileras, just ice boxes. They're extremely cold. People have complained that they're not given adequate food or water. There's no blankets available, and they're treated harshly within those conditions. But it's really in that place that people are first, you know, they first have to indicate whether they have a fear of return. And if they do that, and a Border Patrol officer is supposed to ask them that, then they must be referred to an asylum officer to evaluate whether that person has a credible fear. And so the asylum officer may go to that icebox, to that holding cell area, and interview them, or they'll be transferred to another detention facility where they'll have that interview. And Artesia is one of those places where those interviews can occur. Artesia, New Mexico, which is a federal holding cell for the 672 people who are now detained there. So that's step number one.
I want to ask about step number one for another second.
Oh, sure.
I'm an 11-year-old kid. I'm put into this place without any adults. With adults, what happens to me, and do I have an attorney?
Right, that's a great question. So if you're a child, if you're a child who does not have an adult with them, you are supposed to be treated differently under this process. So a child by themselves, Border Patrol talks to them. They are not, as a matter of practice, supposed to be put into expedited removal because of their age, right? They don't know the laws, they don't know what's going on, and there's a real risk that we will send kids back to their death. So if you were a child who the government thinks is unaccompanied, that's how they define it, if you're an unaccompanied child, then you will be put into a separate process, and you will have a chance to apply for asylum. And that chance to apply for asylum is still incredibly difficult because you apply for asylum without an attorney, right? Unless you can find pro bono counsel or nonprofit organization that is willing to represent you, that child by themselves will have to represent themselves before the immigration court.
Wow. And where they stay during this whole period, this can last for a while.
They have been transferred all over the country. There are children, you know, we had our membership meeting recently. There are children in New Jersey. There are children in Washington State. There are children in Texas. There are children in Los Angeles. There are children in Florida. There are huge numbers of children that are going all across the country. And there is a sense of panic, really, amongst the advocates who are seeing these children and don't really have a way to represent them, right? Because there are so many of them who are going before a judge and going before a DHS trial attorney, a trained trial attorney, is trying to deport them. You know, children are not always able to talk about what happened to them, right? They can't talk if they were raped, right, and they fled a rape, or if they were attacked, or if they fear being recruited into a gang, or if they were brutalized by a gang. Children aren't always able to talk about it in the way that a judge may talk to them about it. So there are definitely cases like that. And in fact, one of our members filed a lawsuit, a different lawsuit specifically on that issue, a class action in California, where they've demanded that the government stop this process and assign counsel for those children. That case is called JEFM, and it was basically an injunctive action to block the government for pursuing deportation proceedings against children unless it ensures those children have legal representation. And they filed it, of course, because it's a class action on behalf of thousands of children who are before judges in that process. And, you know, among the plaintiffs, you have a 10-year-old boy, his 13-year-old brother, and a 15-year-old sister whose father was murdered in front of them. And he was targeted because he and his His father and their mother ran a rehabilitation center for people trying to leave gangs. A 14-year-old girl who had been living with their grandparents but was forced to flee El Salvador after being threatened and then attacked by gang members. A 15-year-old boy who was abandoned and abused in Guatemala and came to the United States. There is specific immigration laws that help children who've been abandoned and abused by their parents. If they come here alone, there is a special law that they can apply for. Those are some of the plaintiffs in this action. And they talk a lot about the abuse that they suffered, you know, within their first encounters with Customs and Border Patrol. And in this lawsuit that was filed against the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security, and the lawsuit is called JEFM versus Holder, you know, they really talked about the imminent threat of being deported, potentially to their death, against their own deportation without any legal advice or legal information.
And now, Paramita, now I think we're moving toward your lawsuit, right?
Right, exactly. Okay. So that's one lawsuit. Right. That was an access to counsel lawsuit. Our lawsuit was different. When somebody comes to the border and asks for asylum, they're usually met with a process called expedited removal. And this applies to adults and families who are encountered at the border by a Border Patrol agent. And at first, you are interviewed by a Border Patrol agent, and they conduct a series of questions to see whether you have a fear of returning. And these are very brief questions. And at that point, and this is the first step, if they get information to think that if you have a fear of returning to your home country, then you can apply for asylum to the United States. So that first step is basically a step where they refer you to an asylum officer, and the asylum officer interviews you to determine if you have what's called a credible fear of return. If the asylum officer finds you have a credible fear, then you get to have an asylum hearing before an immigration judge. So you don't get a hearing before an immigration judge right away. First, an asylum officer has to find that you have a credible fear. Then you can go and have an asylum hearing before an immigration judge. That's the first step. But the asylum officer finds that you don't have a credible fear, then what you have to do is ask for an immigration judge to review the asylum officer's decision, and that's the second stage. In that second stage, an immigration officer will conduct an interview of that person to see if they have a credible fear, and the immigration judge will then either affirm the asylum officer's review or overturn it. And if they overturn the review, that person goes and has an asylum hearing. So that is typically what happens. It's actually a multi-stage process. It's not easy to navigate. But the role of the immigration judge is actually pretty important because they can reverse an asylum officer's decision so a person gets a full asylum hearing. But if the immigration judge agrees with the asylum officer on a negative credible fear finding, then the government gets to deport you quickly. And there have been multiple deportations of families already from Artesia, the federal detention center that is holding, you know, upwards of 500 families in that center.
We're speaking with attorney Paramita Shah, who's the associate director of the National Immigration Project. Paramita, what kind of relief does your lawsuit ask for?
What the lawsuit was asking us, the government to do was to stop the expedited removal process, this new process that the government had implemented. And so even though we had expedited removal before, we think that the government has announced a number of policies in which they've changed their position on expedited removal. And how did, you know, the government change its position? Well, first, Secretary Jay Johnson, who's the Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, came out sometime in July before a meeting, before a hearing in Congress, where he testified that, you know, to families who are coming across the United States, we will send you back. You know, he didn't talk about asylum. He didn't talk about the need to uphold a person's right to apply for asylum if they had a right to asylum, or to ensure that a person had a fair deportation process. He essentially said that we were going to deport you. And in this lawsuit, what we're asking the government to do is to stop that process of denying a fair deportation process to the mothers and children who have fled extreme violence, death threats, rape, and persecution. And the reason why we think the government is violating its long-established constitutional and statutory law around asylum, around the Convention Against Torture, and around due process is that it's categorically prejudged these asylum cases by denying them at the first instance, in that first stage. So an example of that would be in the first step that I just described, before the announcement of this process, nationwide, credible fears had a grant rate of 77%. In Artesia, the credible fear grant rate has dropped to 37%.
Wow, so that's quite extreme.
You know, that in and of itself is a very troubling statistic. Why do we see such a just a precipitous drop in grants of credible fear at this time when the government has announced that, you know, there is a crisis at our borders and, you know, our position now is that we will send you back? So we think that they've, you know, in a way, categorically prejudged asylum cases. Next is that they've drastically restricted communication with the outside world for the families that are held there at this remote detention center. So Artesia is located in New Mexico. It is 200 miles away from El Paso. The closest airport is Roswell, New Mexico. It is remote. There's not many services there. It's very hard to even set up basic communication, computers. And for a long time, it was just even very difficult to meet with clients in Artesia. And so a pro bono project in Artesia that was set up through the efforts of one organization, American Immigration Lawyers Association, those volunteer attorneys, you know, testified and their declarations are public. They talked about how women were trying to make phone calls but were told to get off. They were cut after 3 minutes when consulting with their attorneys. It made it impossible for them to get help. Another way that people felt that their claims were prejudged is that immigration officers within the facility were told that they shouldn't apply for asylum, that they would get deported immediately, and that the purpose of this detention center was for them to be deported as quickly as possible. Another example of the type of coercion that impacted the way for people to even try to defend themselves or for attorneys to even try to help their clients was that these detainees really had no notice of critically important interviews. One example of this, and I used to watch this because the irony of this whole process is though Artesia is in New Mexico, the immigration court that is holding these hearings around Artesia is in Arlington, Virginia. And they're conducting all of the hearings by video.
I was going to say, the clients then are sitting in some courtroom in Artesia, right?
Right, 2,000 miles away, right from Artesia.
Oh, my gosh.
What a nightmare. So what stage is your lawsuit at? Tell us when you expect to get a decision on it and what you expect is going to happen.
So we just filed the lawsuit on August 21st. And, you know, I think we're waiting to see how the government's going to respond. And it's a complaint for declarative and injunctive relief where we're hoping that the government will stop its practice of expediting the deportation of these women and children and that it will stop the practice of conducting the asylum hearings that they're going through. And if there's one thing that I would want to put a picture in your listeners' minds, it's, you know, the stories that we're hearing. So if you can envision, you know, that somebody is sitting in Artesia, that they're being forced to present an asylum case to an immigration judge sitting in Arlington, Virginia, that the average age of a child in Artesia is 6, and that they're kept with their mother throughout the entire process while the mothers recount gruesome stories of rape and sexual assault or murders that they've witnessed of their loved ones. I think you can only imagine the type of hardship that is being experienced by the people in this remote area being forced to, you know, defend themselves against a system that is not really trying to give them a fair shot, but trying to deport them as quickly as possible. And the way that it tried to deport them as quickly as possible was at its very first instance, was by saying that we're not going to agree that you have a credible fear of persecution. And statistically, we've seen that in the accounts, we've seen that. And we think that all of those things together really show that the government has ignored its constitutional and statutory obligations to the people in Artesia who are fleeing persecution.
Yeah, and the irony, of course, in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras, where the United States supported a coup in 2009, the irony is that the United States policies have really been policies that have forced these people to flee. And when they come here, they turn them around and send them back as soon as they can. So we're very grateful for the good work you're doing, Paramita. NationalImmigrationProject.org.
And what I think may be even more interesting for your listeners and for you is to read the declarations of the attorneys who have been volunteering there and to write down what they've experienced trying to represent these women and children in, frankly, horrendous conditions is pretty eye-opening.
Paramita, really, thank you for being with us and even more for bringing that lawsuit.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Okay.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder.